The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
You who weren't here last week, I gave a talk about a Chinese folktale that spoke to the issue of disintegration and then reintegration, and how it's easy to get disintegrated, how to get, in a sense, kind of split from oneself by what we pursue or what we try to avoid. And it's sometimes at a cost, we separate out from part of who we are. And then in the folktale, this woman who's been split, disintegrated, finds herself integrated, becoming whole again. And I want to continue on this theme. And the main point I want to make today is that one of the great tools or great ways of finding us, of doing that integration work, is through the body, through the mindfulness of the body. Our physical body, paying attention to our body, is a fantastic way of bringing together all the things that the mind splits. It's very hard to keep the body split or fragmented. And so as we begin developing awareness of the body and all the different aspects of the body, it tends to bring together the disintegrated parts. And some people would say it brings into play, into awareness, the unconscious parts of who we are, or subconscious parts. And so much so that I like to say that the body is the royal road to the unconscious. To paraphrase from famous quote. So today I'd like to start with a reading from one of the great modern forest meditation teachers, monks in Thailand, named Ajahn Tait. And he wrote an autobiography. And there's one chapter where he refers to himself in the third person. It was a novice Tait. So here he's talking about when he was a novice. It was a novice Tait who became a millionaire. Here I am talking about the time when the government thought up the idea of creating one new millionaire every year in Thailand. They thus brought out an annual lottery with a first prize of 50 or 60,000 baht. In those days, this was considered a fortune large enough for a Thai millionaire. It was all done so that we Thais would not feel humiliated before other richer countries. One night, it so happened that Novice Tait was unable to sleep because he had just won first prize in the lottery. It was time to set about finding the site to build himself a grand and extensive three-story mansion. This residence would be furnished in the most modern designs and be situated in the center of the commercial district. The employees and assistants would have to fill the shelves with every imaginable kind of merchandise. He would be at ease in body and mind without a worry in the world, and spend his time lounging on a sofa, making eyes at the attractive young women who would come in to shop. Whoever chanced a glance in his direction and smiled would receive a happy smile back. Throughout his life of 18 or 19 years, he had never known greater happiness. He had indeed attained the rank of millionaire, just as the government had wished. Yes, yet then, within the blink of an eye, with all the things still fresh and new, impermanence intrudes. Ah, impermanence. All abruptly fades and disappears from his heart, and that's something he regrets so much. Novice Tait comes to his senses and he realizes that it is already late into the night. It should already be time for sleep. Hey, why is this? Not only has a lottery yet to take place, but I haven't even bought a ticket. How come I've already become a millionaire? I must be going crazy. That night he felt an unspeakable degree of shame. If any knowledgeable persons were to know about these fantasies, what would they say? He finally fell asleep and awoke at dawn, feeling guilty. This was an occurrence that he never told anyone about until he wrote his book. So this kind of thing can often happen, meditators or other people, where, especially in meditation, where you get, there's a fantasy, some thought that arises, and people enter into this world of the fantasy. But it also happens in daily life, where some fantasy, some idea, some dream, it can be a beautiful dream, it can be a nightmare of a dream, is something that we inhabit, we get involved in, and we live in it. And it might not have much bearing to what's actually going on. And then occasionally we wake up. Oh, wow. It not only has there not been a lottery yet, but I didn't even buy a ticket. But the cost of that kind of going off into fantasy is a kind of disintegration from who we are, from the fullness of who we are, being integrated, being whole, because there's a loss of contact. Disintegration, one of the things this means is a loss of contact with something. And so we're so involved in a fantasy or a thought or an idea or a particular feeling or resisting or blocking certain feelings that we're not in contact with something, another part of who we are. And some of this now continues to work through us, even though we're not so much aware of it, we're not in contact with it. And so there can be things come around and bite us. It can affect our behavior, what we say to others, how we see others, because there's kind of this other picture going on, other ideas going on in the background that that still need to come out, but we're kind of blocked and being resistant of. So in thinking of mindfulness of the body, I think of that there's kind of three stages of awareness. One is awareness where we're unaware. We're not simply not aware of the body, simply not aware of what's going on at all. And I'd like to give the example of many years ago. I was a graduate student here at Stanford, but I needed a book from the UC Berkeley Library. And so I went all the way up there to get this very important book. And for some reason, it was not on the shelves, and it hadn't been checked out, and so I had a very good hunch that it was in the back room behind the checkout clerk's, you know, office. They hadn't put it back on the shelf or something. I don't know why I had the idea, but... And so I went up to the library clerk and asked if, you know, the book is missing, and could they look for it? And they said, oh, no. And I tried to explain to them how important it was for me, and could they please go and look for it? No. And so then finally, this conversation went on for a while, and a little more senior librarian came by and said, "Oh, you know, wait a minute. You know, I'll go look in the back." When I finally got someone to look, you know, then only then did it occur to me to practice mindfulness of the body. A little bit of a habit of mine to notice my body. So finally, a little bit late, but finally. And to my surprise, I found myself maybe on my tippy toes, projecting and leaning over the counter over into the... I don't think it was just a simple kind of relaxed conversation, you know. And so the first indication I had of, you know, how possessed I was about this, you know, my drive to get this book was when I focused on my body and felt what was going on in my posture. So there was an example where I was so involved in what I wanted that I lost a certain degree of awareness. I wasn't aware of what was going on. Other times, there can be a dissociated awareness where we are kind of aware of what's going on somewhat, but parts of us we're disassociated, we're not paying attention to. And the body is a prime place where there's a certain level of disconnect, loss of contact or dissociation for many of us. Some of it can easily happen because we're just busy. It's possible to run around so much that being so busy doing so many different things that we're not aware of what the cost is for our body, what's going on for our body, or what we can learn about ourselves and our attitude, our feelings, by just tuning into our body. I was so busy getting that book that, I wasn't paying attention to my body. But there also can be attitudes about the body that help support a disconnect There's attitudes of shame that some people feel, attitudes of the body doesn't count, it's not important, attitudes of, you know, some things like that. And some, for some people coming out of certain religious backgrounds, those attitudes can be very, very strong. And so they can keep people actually paying attention carefully to what's going on in their body, to learn through their body. Connected to that can be the idea, or I said, body's not important. There are much more important things in the world. There's a world of ideas, politics after all, you know, hugely consequential things, interpersonal relationships and thinking about it and doing it and solving it. There's a whole slew of things that can seem so much more important than this thing that we kind of have to lug around a lot. That seems to kind of be in the way and, you know, whatever. And so it can be hard to understand the value of bringing attention into the body because other things can seem so much more important and valuable. There's also a disconnect that can happen to the body because the body does, the body is where most of our emotions reside. You know, emotions are not disembodied phenomena. You know, it's not like you have this, you know, you have anger or happiness and it's just kind of floating kind of, you know, a foot above your head and, you know, some ethereal space. You don't know you're feeling, you know, all their emotions are manifested through the body. Part of what an emotion is a physical manifestation. It's a mental, physical thing together. And so there are certain emotions that we'd rather not feel, either because we have a philosophy that says we shouldn't feel those, or because they're so painful, or because in and of themselves they're painful, or sometimes the consequence of those emotions of acting on them have been so painful for us. So, so for example, they might have a philosophy, you're not supposed to feel anger, and so then we don't pay attention to the anger, that's, we don't want to notice it's there. And that was an issue for me in my 20s, that I had an image of myself as not an angry person, and so it was, I had these blinders on and couldn't see where I was angry. There's also, some of these can be very painful and difficult. There can be trauma that people experience, very strong trauma. Very strong negative emotions that in order not to feel them because they're too much to handle, people shut down their body. People, not shut them down, but stop paying attention. And it's not uncommon for people on retreats to come to me and say, you know, it's interesting, I don't really feel, I know I have a full body, but you know, I don't feel anything below my waist. Or I don't really feel anything below my neck. You know, it's really only part of my physical body that I'm really aware of and connected to. And people might go through years and years of life before they notice that there's a whole part of their body that they're not really feeling connected to. Very occasionally, it's interesting, there are people who come to me and say that, they say, oh, this is really strange. Now that I'm really paying attention to my body, I realize I'm mostly aware of one half of my body. You know, one side, the left side or the right side. And I don't know why there's a kind of that kind of split that goes on, but left and right. And, you know, and to open to the body, pay attention to the body, can be an undesirable thing to do because to open up to those, to that part of the body is to open up to those feelings. If there are some repressed or held or unresolved feelings that we don't want to pay attention to, and we've kind of stopped paying attention to the body in order to not notice them, then as the body becomes more awake, more aware, those feelings will come, and that's not so good, so then we close down again, one way or the other. And then there's this issue of certain emotions might be fine, emotions in and of themselves, but they have gotten us into trouble. So sometimes love gets people into trouble, occasionally. And so sometimes people have such a bad experience in their interpersonal kind of love relationships that they don't want to open themselves up to falling in love or being in love or trusting someone in that kind of way again. And so they make this kind of almost unconscious, subconscious policy. I'm not going to do that again. I'm not going there again, ever again. I'm not going to be hurt like that again. And so it isn't just simply a mental attitude, but often it comes with a kind of a closing down or shutting down or numbing of part of the body. Another way in which the body becomes kind of disconnected to is through chronic tension, chronic stress. The if a muscle is chronically held tight, it goes numb. And numb means we're not aware of it. And so when we're not aware of the cost of that chronically held tension or holding. And muscles can be held chronically because of, you know, we say stress, but stress is often a symptom of stuck emotions. So we're stuck in anger, stuck in fear in some way. And so as the body goes numb, sometimes the emotions and feelings behind there we're not in contact with and not aware of. And sometimes as the body relaxes, we become aware of the emotions that reside there. People say, talk about emotions residing in the body. So for example, a common place for feeling fear or expressing fear is in the shoulders. The shoulders can go up. And if the fear is chronic, the shoulders will stay up. And if it's stay up chronically enough, it becomes kind of, people become unaware of that. It becomes kind of second nature to be always up. But then if there's some way through meditation or massage or body work or something that those shoulders begin to relax, it's nice enough that they relax, but what then gets highlighted is the fear that somehow triggered it, that was there. And then people are flooded with that fear. They become aware of it. And so then people will think, oh, I'm going backwards in my meditation. You know, here I was relaxing, I was feeling good, and now suddenly I'm afraid. This is a sign that meditation is failing for me. But actually it's not the case at all. Part of the function of meditation is to reawaken and to help with this integration of all these parts of ourselves we've lost contact with. And so part of that is to meet the parts of ourselves that have been difficult, parts of ourselves we've kind of been pushed away or avoided or numbed out on. And so sometimes that comes with flooding of sometimes intense emotions. Sometimes it can come with very strong surges of energy that move through the body in different ways, because those held parts of the muscles, in a sense, seemingly seem to hold a lot of energy there, and as they get released, these things flow much more freely, and it can be sometimes quite intense. What can happen there is that the integration begins to kind of work itself out. So mindfulness of the body then is to bring the body into play, to notice the body and notice what goes on in it, and to awaken all these, the tremendous capacity the body has to feel. The tremendous capacity we have to connect to our emotional life, our attitudinal life, the attitudes we carry, our intentional life, intentions we have, through how those are revealed in our body. And it's very hard sometimes to think our way into, you know, what's going on here? What was really happening with me? The thinking mind is a wonderful tool, but it's not always an accurate tool. It doesn't always have the ability to think clearly. And people can be mystified about what's really going on if we were only thinking about things. But the body is not a mystery, I would say. I mean, the body is not a idea. The body is not in the future. The body is not an imagination about something. The body is one of the kind of realist things we have. And so if you feel what's going on in the body, you're connected here and now, and you're getting some really direct information that's not supposition. So if your shoulders are tight, you can feel that. Oh, shoulders are tight. You might not know why, but you still feel something very immediate and concrete. Now what's interesting is you might not need to know why. The integration process doesn't necessarily require us to know the reason why the shoulders are tight. If we can relax the shoulders and have the whole shoulder area kind of relaxed and sensitive again, so we can help us process and see how we move through life next. So if the shoulders are really relaxed, then next time we get afraid, or maybe notice, oh, the shoulders are going up. Oh, look at that. If they're really tight, the shoulders, and then you get afraid, there's no more room to get any tighter. The shoulders don't reveal much then, because, you understand what I'm saying? So if the shoulders are relaxed, then there's movement as you get afraid, and you can see. It might not be necessary to know why originally the shoulders went up. An integrated body would be relaxed enough to see how, in the next instant, next day or something, the tightness happens. Oh, look at that. Now I see. And then you're connected, and then because you're connected and aware, then you can address it in some more direct way. You can address the object of fear and deal with it, or you can address with the inner psychological things going on. You might just relax your shoulders. So the bringing mindfulness to the body awakens this stuff and is a fantastic place of getting a lot of information about what is going on in our inner life. And that's why the quote, you know, the royal road to the unconscious. There's so much so much of what goes on in our minds and our thoughts, our feelings, is expressed through the body. And one of the places to see that is in our breathing. Breathing is often seen as a wonderful bridge between the conscious and kind of more subconscious or unconscious aspects of who we are. Because all the different kind of subconscious attitudes, reactions we have to our life, many of them will affect how we breathe. Our breathing will change where in the body we breathe, what in the chest, in the belly. Different places get tight or more relaxed. And you can actually feel this tremendous play and variation in how we breathe depending on how we react to what's going on. If the breath is always tight, like the belly is always, you know, pulled in and tight, then there's not much play and you can't necessarily see the variations. But as the breath becomes more and more relaxed, the breathing, the chest and the belly, then there's more and more subtle variations you can see in how we breathe. And each of those can be a feedback loop to show us, oh, look at that. I wonder why I tightened up there. Oh, that's because I was afraid. Or why did I soften there? Oh, because I feel trust now. And as we use the breath as a feedback loop and noticing how we tighten up on the breath, then if we can soften the breath, let the breath be kind of more relaxed again, that lubricates the inner life. The emotional psychological life. It's harder to get fixated around certain emotions if the breathing is fluid and relaxed. So, you know, as some of you know, I call resentment frozen anger. And so it's interesting, next time you feel resentment, to notice how that's affected your breathing. And if you feel that it does affect your breathing, you're more tight, more shallow, maybe breathing more from your chest, something faster than you usually do perhaps. And then see if you can adjust your breathing. See if you can relax it and soften it. And if you can are successful in relaxing and softening your breathing, how has that affected your resentment? And chances are that if your breathing is really relaxed, it's hard to stay stuck or frozen around certain emotions. And when the emotions are not frozen, then they can move through us. If resentment can come back to becoming just plain old anger, the anger, which is not we're not stuck with, has a chance to move through us, to inform us, to kind of we can work with it much more effectively than I think resentment, which involves a kind of disconnect, disintegration. So in our tradition, we put a lot of emphasis on mindfulness of breathing. It's a wonderful concentration practice. It's a wonderful mindfulness practice. But it's also a wonderful a way of beginning this process of integration. And as the breathing becomes something, we have greater awareness of the breathing, we wake up to more and more the range of how we breathe, what goes on with breathing. As we become more sensitive to that part of our body that breathes, the more we'll have access to how the breathing changes. The more we have access to how the breathing changes, the more we'll have access to noticing what we're feeling and also being able to come back to more relaxed breath so we're not kind of lopsided in our preoccupation with, you know, a particular emotion or feeling or attitude. And then from that, we extend it out into the rest of our body. And as we become more aware of the rest of our body, then it gives us a lot of information of what's going on in our life. And I would say much more accurate information. And the other thing it does is not only information, but it also helps support the inner processing. It's my experience and my sense that the inner psyche has its own way of healing, own way of coming to wholeness, own way of wanting to come to integration. It takes a lot of energy to be disintegrated. It takes a lot of energy to hold certain parts of our personality, our feelings, emotional life at bay. And that energy is exhausting. And so because of that, that all the energy it takes, I like to say, well, the natural tendency is to want to not do so much work. Natural tendency is, you know, if you hold You know, if you hold a heavy ball above your head for a long time, the natural tendency is for the ball to want to come to the ground. And you have to kind of, you know, because of gravity, and so you have to kind of resist that gravity and hold it up until you get exhausted. But if you kind of listen to that kind of, in a sense, the call of nature to, you know, release that tension of holding that ball all the time, then you'll put it down on the ground. So if there's all this effort and energy into being disintegrated, to hold things at bay, if you pay careful attention to that, you'll almost feel there's a desire to integrate, or there's a momentum to integrate, simply in the fact that that part of us wants to relax and not work. And so, but it's not an easy process sometimes. So I think, for example, as people meditate, there's sometimes a tendency to get more relaxed, more concentrated, more still. And then at some occasions, there are occasional times for some people where they can't get any more concentrated. And they'll try really hard to get more concentrated, and they just can't, the mind just can't get concentrated anymore. And sometimes people then will think it's a personal fault. I just don't have strong concentration ability, so I just, you know, I can't really do this. It's possible the person has all the concentration ability they ever need for meditation, but what's happened is that the awareness has encountered something that doesn't want to open up. Something, some blockage, some resistance there, some place where we're disintegrated. And sometimes what it takes is just hanging in there, just staying present, keep coming back, being present. Not getting discouraged because the meditation is not working. It's always working. Meditation is one of those things that can never not work. So if you think it's not working, that's just it's always working. But you have to keep doing it. It only doesn't work if you don't do it. And that's what happens to some people. Some people stop doing it and then they say it doesn't work. But sometimes it doesn't work the way you want it to work. And that's a different question. So sometimes when there's a blockage or resistance or some disintegrated part that doesn't want to kind of, there's a lot of, sometimes you have to keep coming back until somehow, mysteriously, something opens up. Occasionally I've known people where it's by staying in it, staying present, keep doing the best they can, and then at some point the person lets down their guard. At some point, the person relaxes or doesn't try so hard. And at the moment of letting down their guard, that something floods up, floods out. And they say, oh my God. Oh, wow. That's quite something. I didn't know that was in there. And then there's a whole period of time where the person needs to integrate that or work with that or be present for that and allow that to come through. I say this partly because what I was trying to say earlier is that I think there's an inner psychological or psychic or psychological momentum towards healing. Just as if physically, if you cut your finger a little bit, have a little cut, you have to keep the finger clean and put a band-aid over it. But there's a kind of, if everything's going well in your body, then there's a natural tendency to for the body to heal that cut. And so seemingly same thing with our emotional or psychological life. There's a momentum towards healing. If we just get out of the way, if we create the right conditions, put a band-aid over it. And I think of mindfulness as the great band-aid. Mindfulness is kind of leaving it alone, keeping it clean, not getting caught up in it, not interfering with it, not attacking it, just letting it be in a safe way. And then this inner processing, the inner unfolding that needs to happen, the inner healing can move through us. And I think it's quite remarkable how much resolution can happen to our psychological difficulties if we allow the inner unfolding to just do itself, not interfere with it. And the number one way to help that happen is to be aware of what's going on in the body, to open to the body, feel the body, just connect to the body, because all these things are expressed through the body, and if we're aware of it in the body, then we're not going to add a story to it. We're not going to add all our dreams and fantasies about it. The body is not a story. And if we can feel how it's expressed through the body, it's a great way of getting out of the story, which often interferes with the processing, and out of the beliefs and ideas, and let this inner life kind of move through us. So to feel, for example, feel the anger in your belly, and rather than thinking about, you know, why am I angry, who's at fault and all that, to go down and feel what's happening in the belly with the anger and be present for it there, and then see how that belly feeling of anger moves and shifts and changes as you allow it to be there, as you give it permission to be there, and you're not reacting to it or reacting to the anger or believing the anger or acting on the anger, but just letting it be there. So by being relaxed enough to turn the attention into the body becomes the vehicle for this fantastic inner process towards integration. And as we become more integrated, then we are able to understand ourselves a lot better. And as we become more integrated, then I think we can make wiser choices about how we live this life of ours. So I hope that was an okay pep talk for mindfulness of the body. It's been one of my surprises in Buddhist practice to discover my body, and and then discover how helpful the body is, and then discover how amazingly beautiful and the experience of being embodied can be. It's a beautiful thing to be embodied, present that way. So do you have any questions or comments or protests you'd like to make?
I get how to access like the muscles of the back, but stress is so often expressed through like the stomach, ulcers. I'm one of those. And I've not been able to access that, you know, the internal organs. Can you provide any advice or guidance on that?
I don't know how all these things, you know, physiologically work. I don't know if we need to be aware of the acids in our stomach and necessarily, and maybe that's a symptomatic of something else. So if, for example, someone's getting ulcers because of fear, and that's secreting more extra acids in the belly and all that, you can certainly be aware of the pain of the ulcer, perhaps, but that's not really the important place of paying attention. There's probably the manifestation of fear somewhere else. The way that fear expresses itself in the moment might be a tightening of the belly, or a tightening of the shoulders, or a tightening of the neck muscles, or something. And the burning of the ulcer is secondary. And so, if you focus too much on the burning ulcer, you can get very concentrated, but it won't help you become aware of the fear itself, because that's being manifested somewhere else. That makes sense? Mm-hmm. Now, I think maybe sometimes ulcers have no psychological cause at all. So the fact that the body hurts doesn't mean that there's some spiritual, psychological process that needs to happen. Maybe you just need to take an antacid.
So jumping off of that, I'm wondering what to do about just non-psychogenic pain.
Non-psychogenic
pain, organic pain, as a major obstacle for a lot of people toward a mindfulness of the body. If we're so enveloped in pain, how do we get past that to think about or to access anything greater than just that pain, that physical pain?
It's a great question, and depending on the particular person, it's probably different responses are appropriate. But I think we want to be careful about getting beyond pain to these other things, but rather we go through the pain. And so there can be a lot of physiologically based pain that people experience that can become a very good subject for mindfulness itself, can actually help people develop a lot of mindfulness. And the mindfulness practice might not help with the pain itself, but as we stay really present for the physical pain, it's possible to become aware of all the secondary reactions to it that kind of hold it, to house it. And mindfulness can help us resolve some of those. And sometimes the real issue, the psychological issue for why the pain is so difficult, is psychological. So there's fear, there's resentment, there's a lot of tightening and resistance to it. I remember once I had a lot of knee pain meditating, and every time that what I noticed was that if I had thoughts of aversion or self-pity about all this pain, I could see the very subtly the muscles around my knee tighten up, and I'd feel more pain. And if I let go of those thoughts, I still had pain, but then it became much more manageable. And I've had very intense physical pain, and at the same time sat in states of bliss. So the fact that there's pain doesn't have to have impact on our inner psychological or spiritual well-being. And how to, in a healthy way, not get to decouple that so that the pain doesn't affect our psychological life is one of the great functions of mindfulness. And one of the ways to do that is to be very present for the pain and learn how not to be non-reactive to the pain, develop a certain kind of equanimity to the pain. And when we find that equanimity, then we also begin finding all, or in the process of doing that, finding all the secondary kind of things that are making it more complicated than it needs to be. Does that seem like an okay answer?
Thank you.
Over here.
Just this conversation reminds me, many of you might have read the book by Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now. In that book, which I'm in the middle of at the moment, he talks a lot about the pain body and that we all experience pain, but the important thing is not to identify with pain, have the pain become who you are. And so part of the practice that he suggests is to, when you're experiencing pain, to label it or give it a notice. Oh, pain. I'm experiencing pain. And when you label it, it isn't you. It is something you're experiencing in that moment. You don't run from it, but you work through it, as you said, Gil.
Yeah.
And so I think the thing isn't as easy for those of us who don't have chronic pain, perhaps someone who does. My mother has rheumatoid arthritis, so she experiences it every single day. And I think it's harder in that event for someone like me to understand. But I think as long as we don't identify with it, just as we wouldn't, you try not to identify with everything being wonderful and good and
right.
Healthy all the time. That's not you either. It's a moment that's passing, yeah. And you recognize it.
Yeah, that's very wise. And there's ways in which identifying with the pain is part of that secondary reactions that makes it more complicated and makes it harder for us. So learning to see it as the pain as opposed to my pain can be very helpful. And so I'll end by saying that the more you become aware of your body, the more you include your body as the field of awareness, let your mindfulness come through the body, the more your body becomes your teacher. And you don't have to rely so much on books and teachers outside of you. And it's my mission in life to help all of you. My mission in life is to help make teachers superfluous. And so one big step in that way is to really kind of get into your body and really let the body really help you understand more deeply what's really going on for you in your life. So many thanks, and I'm not sure when I'll see you again, but Beth Goldring will be here next week, and it might be a few weeks before I come back again on Sunday. Thank you.